And that music can only mean one thing. It's time for another edition of the Delaware Valley Journal On The Air, our weekly podcast from DelawareValleyJournal.com, where I'm joined by the editor, Todd Shepard. And Todd, after reading the Delaware Valley Journal this week, I have one message for you. Don't shoot. Apparently, you and all the gang in the Delaware Valley are running out and buying guns everywhere you can. Is that right?
Yeah, and what's really incredible about that is obviously just getting out in the community at some times was difficult enough. And at other times, some sheriff's offices had their gun permitting sections of their offices closed down because of COVID. And still, there's been this remarkable increase. I think that tracks intuitively with most with what everyone has sort of heard anecdotally, but it was nice to get some hard data. Yeah, so let me just give you the numbers really quickly. If we're looking at Montgomery County, permits there up 33%, Chester County up 27%.
And that's a surge that we haven't seen in this area just from people deciding, hey, I've always wanted to own a gun. This is a surge that we are seeing around the country due to, holy crap, there's stuff burning in the streets and we don't know what's going to happen with COVID.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there have been times in the past where there have been similar increases. Those usually come after like a major shooting incident, maybe say the Las Vegas incident, and people were worried that some new kind of gun control law might come down. But absolutely. And we talked to a gun store and they said, we're definitely hearing it straight from the customers' mouths that they were worried about the unrest at the beginning of the COVID crisis. And then obviously there was the George Floyd unrest that happened a couple of months after that.
And there's another incident that has inspired gun sales in the past, and that is electing Democrats president of the United States. Barack Obama was his nickname among my gun activist friends was the world's best gun seller because he was, you know, openly less than affectionate about the Second Amendment's, you know, standing and people purchasing guns. And that message has gotten drifted out. And people forget, but Joe Biden has said who he would put in charge of his gun policy, former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke, who said, I want national mandatory gun confiscation for certain kinds of guns, something that that Biden has not agreed to. But he has said he wants to ban the future sale of guns and he wants a voluntary gun buyback program. All that together, Todd, means that if Biden wins the White House, these gun sellers are probably going to be busy well into next year.
Yeah, and the state background check that helps on getting these sheriffs to license the permits, they will absolutely have to make sure that, you know, they crashed for a little bit back in March. There was such an overwhelming wave, right? So they're going to have to be ready. But your mention that that Barack Obama was the best gun seller in the history of the world sounds just a little reminiscent of Governor Wolf being Employee of the Month for the restaurant out in Ohio, doesn't it?
And since Biden's name has been evoked, let's talk a little bit about good old-fashioned politics. Interesting poll from Monmouth showing that Biden has just a 3-point lead in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, here's what I am really starting to track a little bit right now is I just can't get off of this silent majority or the silent Trump voter issue. And listeners to our podcast will remember last week we talked to Christopher Borick. He actually does polling for Muhlenberg College. And we did a story on that he said, look, there are some silent Trump voters out there, but I don't think they're that important or they're not big enough. They're not a big enough group to really impact either the polling or the outcome of the election in Pennsylvania. I will say I was listening to the Chuck Toddcast. This is Chuck Todd's podcast.
Right. He's Charlie the NBC political analyst.
Yeah, head of the NBC Political Reporting Bureau. And he was talking with Charlie Cook and Larry Sabato. And I'm sorry, I can't remember which one specifically, but one of those two said, it's really caught my ear where they said, people are not telling the truth to pollsters. I'm starting to see trends where I'm seeing a lot of unreliable data. I'm seeing a lot of polling answers that don't gel with all of the other essentials of the poll. So
right.
I think it's still something that we've got to keep an eye out on, especially in Pennsylvania. I think Pennsylvania, it really is the Pennsylvania and Wisconsin appear to be the ones where the tightening is happening thus far and they appear to be of the swing states that Trump won in 2016. I think Pennsylvania and Wisconsin are the most important ones at this point.
I talked to a Republican pollster and acknowledge that this is a Republican pollster out of D.C. just 2 days ago who said, here's what we are hearing. People are saying to us straight up, there is no way I'm going to admit to a stranger over the phone that I support Donald Trump. And they're saying this, these people are, because they see what's happening where you're sitting at a diner and a group of, you know, activists show up and start screaming and yelling at you. They see people who are getting in trouble at work just for, you know, having a Trump bumper sticker. They see, you know, people arrested for attacking folks for wearing a MAGA hat. And they're saying, I don't, this person says it's a poll. It could just be, you know, someone in the community who wants to spot the Trump people saying, come get us. And that may sound like paranoia. And in fact, it may be paranoia. But what do we know about paranoia, Todd?
Even if you're paranoid, it doesn't mean they're not out to get you.
Exactly. And then the second thing that I think is interesting about this is Sean Trendy, a very smart numbers cruncher who's been at Real Clear Politics for a while, noted this week that he thinks it's fascinating that the state that Trump seems the most likely to hold on to out of the big three. Remember, Trump, if Trump holds everything else, he only needs to win one of Wisconsin, Michigan, or Pennsylvania to keep the White House. And Trendy said he never would have guessed that the one that Trump is having the best result in would be Pennsylvania. He thought Pennsylvania would be the toughest for Trump to hold on to. And that's a fascinating insight. And you had a fascinating insight that you stole, that you wrote about. Yes, that's the word, Todd, from Ballotopia. They did an analysis of the states with the most and least competitive in-state politics.
Ballotpedia. And when you think about competitiveness, you immediately sort of ask yourself, well, are maybe either of the chambers in the state legislature about to, switch majority power? That's a little bit of a possibility in the Pennsylvania House this year. So you would say, well, that's got to be pretty competitive, right? Not exactly. When you look at the all of the 203 races for the House, you start to look at some different equations, like how many open seats are there? How many incumbents even had to face a primary challenger? And then how many people eventually go on to just run their race and they don't even have a challenger from the other party? When you start to combine all that, Pennsylvania is actually not that competitive. It's in the lower, almost in the lower quarter, which I think is probably surprising to a lot of Pennsylvanians who think that just because the window is tight in the House, that it's actually a very competitive state.
Well, but it could be far, far worse. The numbers you had from, or Ballotopia had from Massachusetts were just fascinating.
Right, because here's the deal is these uncontested races where someone just goes on to, you know, that once they win their primary, they're essentially guaranteed the seat because they won't be opposed by someone from the other party. Generally, in other states, the unopposed races are incredibly tilted towards one party. As you said, Massachusetts, the numbers there for all of these unopposed races, they're almost all Democrats in perfectly Democrat safe seats. What's different about Pennsylvania is these perfectly safe seats, they are, they're very evenly split between Republicans and Democrats. My theory here is Pennsylvania has so many representatives. 200 is a lot in a state. That's more than you'll find in nearly any other state. That it forces the districts, it forces some equality over the districts, and it makes it a lot harder to gerrymander is my, you know, theory there. Or even if there is, it has to be a lot, it has to be more equally split between the two parties. You can't avoid it with that many seats. If you were to draw up 2,000 districts, again, you would still get more, and the parity would get closer and closer to the actual voter registration of the state.
That's possible. New Hampshire has the largest state legislature in the country per capita. In fact, it's the fourth largest Democratic legislature in the world for a state of only one, that's smaller than the four counties of the Delaware Valley Journal. But they have a lot of swing action in their legislature up there. So it'll be it flipped in 2016, flipped again in 2018. So there's a lot of that. But Massachusetts, 40 state senators, three of them are Republicans. Three.
Right.
That's and almost no contested contest at all. The primary is it. They haven't elected a member of Congress to go to Washington, D.C. since 1994. Not one. So, you know, as it may be partisan in New Hampshire, I mean, in Pennsylvania, but it ain't that bad. Hey, I'll tell you where it's good is the world of real estate in the Delaware Valley. Remember a few months ago, there were opponents of the pipeline, the Mariner East pipeline, saying, you've got to stop this pipeline because it's going to kill my property values. And now some of those same activists are saying, hey, we want property tax relief. Our property values are too high. Well, they're not going to get any more relief anytime soon, are they, Todd?
They are not. I mean, I'm having to almost stifle my laugh when I say that, because in that same story you're talking about, we talked to a tax attorney who said, yeah, I'm starting to hear rumblings. There could be a lot of pricing pressure on the suburbs as people leave the city. But that, as you said, that was a couple or 3 months ago. Well, I talked to some real estate professionals, some agents this week, and let me tell you, the stories they told me were eye-popping. Buyers are saying, oh, we'll waive the inspection. We'll waive everything else. We've got cash. We just want to buy now. The agents were saying the showings per house are going well beyond their expectations, to where they're just having to cut off the showings. More offers than they can count, to where they're just essentially they're only looking at the cash offers. And that would be one thing. But the agents are also saying, look, there's a noticeable trend about the need for more space and the need for more amenities, swimming pools. A big one is the issue of more space for home office space. Now that more people are working from home, actually having some space to dedicate, maybe it would have been a spare bedroom, but now turning that into a classroom for a kid who might be at home for the rest of this year, you know? So, long story short is right now it's been not necessarily an incredible seller's market in the Delaware Valley over the last, it's been a good seller's market over the last several years, but now the pressure is starting to come on even faster and homes are selling far more quickly. It's incredible. And both these agents said, we've never really seen anything like this.
One more thing before we get to our podcast guest, Todd. This is this week was the 19th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attack. And it was fascinating to me, the number of people I heard say, oh my gosh, it's 9/11. I didn't thought about it. It's 9/11. And it really did get lost, the buildup to it in the politics of the day. I mean, you know, Donald Trump is such a huge political force. The reaction to Trump is just as big. And it's fascinating how we, you know, that events of the moment have swamped this never forget time. But listening to people talk about it today and trying to compare the politics of today, comparing Donald Trump to the 9/11 terrorists, you just go, wow. If you had told an American 15 years ago that you'd have those kinds of attacks at the presidential level, I don't think people would have believed you. They just said, no, 9/11 is too important. It's too sacred. It's too unique. It's such a hideous act of evil. And, you know, it's beyond partisan politics. And, well, obviously it's not.
Yeah, and it is hard to imagine. I'm one of those people where, as I was working this morning, I had to date something. And when I typed it out, it sort of hit me again that it was upon us. And it didn't feel like it was that time of year again. I think that that's in part that everyone's lost this sense of time because they've been at home for so long.
Oh, good point.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So that I can understand it in that way, but also the news cycles, you were sort of alluding to the news cycles, and especially this week with the Woodward book and everything, the news cycles have just been so crazy and repetitive. I mean, the news cycles are down to 10-minute little, right? And that also distorts your sense of time. And so all of that, I think, is what's come together. But already, just doing some little cursory searching on Twitter this morning, you could still see that same love and support and just the terrible loss that was suffered on that day that I know we will all genuinely never forget. That's not a cliche. That's not a saying. It's the genuine feeling in all of our hearts.
Well said, Todd Shepherd, as always. I understand that when it comes to partisanship in Pennsylvania and perhaps lack thereof, you actually sat down and spoke to one of the people who put that report together.
All right, happy to have with us now on the Delaware Valley Journal podcast, Douglas Kroneisel. He's a staff writer and researcher with Ballotpedia.org. By the way, Ballotpedia, I'm a big fan of. I use them, I would say, almost daily in my researching. They are an online encyclopedia of American politics, and really they have some of the greatest page-by-page and legislator-by-legislator information pages you can find on the internet. Doug, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So we are having you on to talk about a new report from Ballotpedia, new this year, but it's one that you've done for many years now, that looks at the competitiveness of a state politically. And here we're not talking about the presidential election, where I think, you know, people pretty well know that there are those few key battleground states presidentially, like Pennsylvania is, along with Michigan or Wisconsin. Wisconsin more than Michigan so this year, I think. But talk to us about the study you all did and how you look at competitiveness. Here we're talking about House, state legislative House and Senate seats, right?
Yes. Yep. Yeah. So our competitiveness report that we've been putting out since 2010, this is our full decade that we've got here, focuses on state legislative elections. So yes, so state House seat, state Senate seat.
And what goes into making this assessment? As we said in our story, Pennsylvania was 37th. You know, if it were sort of a ranking, Pennsylvania was 37th out of 44 states. I was surprised to learn there are some states that have no General Assembly elections at all this year, which kind of was that was my bit of learning for this week. But what are the factors that go into, you know, deciding whether a race is competitive and then applying that to the whole state?
Yep. So since 2010, since we started putting out this report, we've used three factors that help us determine whether or not a state is has a bit more competition or less competition going on. And those three factors are the number of open seats, so the number of incumbents who are running for re-election versus those who are retiring or not running for re-election, the number of incumbents who are facing primaries. So rather than just facing a general election challenge, the number of incumbents who are being challenged in their party primaries. And then finally, the number of general election seats where there are two major parties competing for the seat. So with all three of those, having more or less in one way or the other impacts the competitiveness. So for instance, more open seats tends to lead to more competitive elections. And obviously, if there are more seats where only Democrats are contesting the seat or only Republicans are contesting the seat, that makes those elections less competitive.
Right. And what other Pennsylvania trends did you notice as what Pennsylvania things stand out to you as you look at it compared to the other states in the nation?
Yeah. So like you mentioned, we have Pennsylvania on our competitiveness index, which is what we use. We kind of take an average of those three factors and we create a competitiveness index. And for Pennsylvania, like you said, we're 27.6 was your index, which is the 34th most competitive state.
Sorry, I thought I might have had the wrong number in my mind. Thanks.
No, that's all right. It's a little bit higher up there. So they're 34th, and then, you know, across the board, something around 8.3% of the seats are open this year. So you've got 8.3% of your 228 seats who are up for election. Incumbents are running for re-election in 91.7% of those seats. 13.4% of those incumbents who are running for re-election are facing primary challenges or faced primary challenges rather. And then 61% of the seats, so over half, have competition in the general election between Democrats and Republicans.
91% of incumbents running again, that sounds really high. But then again, looking at the report, it sounds like you all have discovered that that's a trend nationwide. It was a big year for incumbents to be seeking re-election, right?
Yes. Yeah, actually, this was the highest since we started collecting data in 2010. This is the highest percentage of incumbents seeking re-election. So 85% of all state legislative incumbents across the country in all 5,875 seats that are up for election this year are seeking re-election or have sought re-election and gone through primaries.
So Ballotpedia has a lot of great other resources. For example, I know a page that I've relied on a lot in reporting I've done is it lists the states that have trifectas, which is where, you know, a single party has the House, the Senate, and the governor's mansion. That's just one example. But for example, they also track battleground chambers. So what are, whether it's the House or the Senate in whatever state, which are the most competitive? And it's a little bit funny because Pennsylvania is, the Pennsylvania House is in Ballotpedia's most watched House is one of the most watched chamber races. And so I think that would suggest to some people that Pennsylvania is competitive or it's hot, more highly competitive than some others. So I was trying to think, how do you align that with the study that you have here? And I think I've come up with the apt comparison here. If we take a World Series, if we had an imaginary World Series and the Phillies are playing let's say the hated Houston Astros. If the Phillies win a seven game series, but every game was won, whether it was by the Phillies or the Astros, by a 15-1 margin, would you say that was necessarily a competitive series? Well, it went seven games, but none of the games were, I mean, you could tune them out, you know, whenever because the margin got so big. So a different kind of series might be one where it's a four-game sweep, but the games are one-run margins of each. So this is a sense where we're not really talking about whether the Republicans keep the House or the Democrats possibly win it back. We're talking about if we assess all of these seats at one time. So that's a little bit different, right?
Yes, definitely. When we're coming up with our battleground chambers, there can be chambers where one party, just by virtue of the number of general election races that are happening or aren't happening, more or less has a lock on keeping a majority of the chamber. And so flipping the chamber isn't what makes it a battleground, but maybe right. Some inter-party primary, battles that are going on are what we're most interested in, or what we want to make sure that readers have a good sense of. But then with regards to this competitiveness report, it's more so taking a look at, like you said, at one time, one step back, how does this year 2020 compare to 2018 or to 2016? Right. And we actually have data for Pennsylvania for all three of those election cycles.
But two, as you and I spoke earlier, as I was working on the article, you did pull out this sort of key finding about Pennsylvania in terms of, if we call them these safe seats, there are a lot of seats across the nation where once, probably, and I'm just sort of speaking hypothetically here, let's say it's an incumbent, that once the incumbent wins the primary, it's so well known that they're going to win the general that no one from the other party even rises to put their name on the ballot and challenge them. So these safe seats, they're a little bit different in Pennsylvania. Walk our listeners through that.
Yeah, definitely. So when you see the number of seats that are up for election without major party competition, just across the country, like you were mentioning, those safe seats, that we define those as a seat where, yes, there's a Republican on the ballot and no Democratic candidate on the ballot, or vice versa. And so in a lot of states, you've got it being kind of lopsided. So if you look at a state like, I know one of the examples I was providing with you the other day when we were chatting was Massachusetts. Massachusetts, I think, has the lowest rate of major party competition this year. They've got 200 seats and 140 are guaranteed to Democrats, whereas 19 are guaranteed to Republicans. And then if you look at a state like Wyoming, and these are kind of, if you go over to Wyoming, which I think is the second lowest rate of major party competition, you've got 75 seats up for election, 50 are safe seats for Republicans, 5 are like that for Democrats. But with Pennsylvania this year, there's a lot more parity between the two. So you've got, I believe, 47 seats guaranteed to Democrats and 42 seats guaranteed to Republicans. So that's something that's a little unique with Pennsylvania is you've got still, you know, about a little less than half of, you know, around 40% of the seats are more or less guaranteed to one party or the other. But there's a lot more parity there, which means that if you've got 47 for Democrats, 42 for Republicans, the remaining 139 are being contested by both parties, which means you've got a more or less equal number of seats being contested over in the general elections at the end of the day.
Sounds great. Doug, what other studies should we keep an eye out for from Ballotpedia from now until Election Day?
Well, I mean, we've got full election coverage coming out here with regard to following the federal elections, state executive elections, things like that. So this is our state legislative competitiveness. Between now and Election Day, we're going to be publishing a page on state executive competitiveness. And I know there are some, those are things like governor, auditor, any statewide election position. I know there are a few in Pennsylvania this year.
Right.
And then a congressional competitiveness. So following the Senate races and the U.S. Congress races as to sort of how many people are retiring, who's retiring, why is one party more represented than the other in that statistic. And so those are going to be coming out between now and Election Day. And then after the election, we're going to have a lot of great analysis going on with the presidential results combined with all this information, whether or not any trifectas are impacted and margins of victory and things like that in kind of swing districts.
Sounds great. I'm especially interested to hear about, you know, some of that analysis on retirements, given that there was this wave of GOP retirements in the last 2 years, two or three years, actually. So, Doug Kronisel from Ballotpedia, we really appreciate your time. Keep up the great work. And just thanks so much for joining us on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
I don't know about you, Todd, but I'm ready for a political knife fight. Let's go. Come on.
Yeah.
And if they do break out in the Delaware Valley Journal, you can read about them at DelawareValleyJournal.com, which you can find on your social media at.
Go to Facebook and search New York Times. No, sorry. Go to Facebook and search Delaware Valley Journal. Guaranteed you will find us. It's got a little Liberty Bell. We'd love to have you in our Facebook community. On Twitter, @DV_journal. You can always email me with your story ideas, your tips, or we'd love to have your op-ed submission. I am at Todd@InsideSources.com.
And I am Michael Graham with InsideSources.com. Todd Shepard is the managing editor of Delaware Valley Journal. Thanks so much for listening to this edition of the Delaware Valley Journal on the air.